Usually expect agriculture to be pretty predictable, right?
Right, yeah.
Like you picture a factory with a glass roof,
Right.
you plant a seed in the right dirt, add a specific amount of water, and I mean, the earth just kind of does its predictable math.
Exactly. It's supposed to be a formula.
But when you look at the global green rush, you know, around cannabis and hemp over the last few years, that factory has just been completely overrun.
Oh, absolutely. By chaotic regulations, wild market swings, all of it.
Yeah, and just a whole lot of corporate hype. So if you were trying to understand this space right now, whether you're like an investor or someone watching policy or just someone curious about how this highly stigmatized plant becomes a global commodity.
It is incredibly difficult to separate the actual reality from the marketing brochure.
Exactly. Which is why today's deep dive is so interesting. We're getting into a very specific, grounded playbook.
Yeah, the March 2023 Western Cape Cannabis Framework and Implementation Plan, or the CAN plan for short.
The CAN plan. I
Yeah.
like that.
Prepared by Kaiser EDP and Ignited Unlimited for the agricultural sector down in South Africa.
And the mission for this deep dive is, well, it's fascinating. We are looking at a region with incredibly deep traditional roots in cannabis cultivation.
Right.
And we get to see how they are trying to figure out how to survive and compete in a global market that is, frankly, cutthroat.
Yeah, and constantly shifting. I mean, the rules are being written and rewritten in real time. It's the definition of a deeply uncertain frontier.
So they are looking for a strategic edge. But before any region can build this, you know, billion-dollar industry, they have to look at the dirt in the sky.
The physical reality.
Right. Because you can write all the brilliant policy you want, but if the rain doesn't fall, you don't have a product.
No, you definitely don't.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because looking at this plan, I kept waiting for the part where they reveal their secret geographic advantage.
And spoiler alert, there isn't one.
Right. Diving into the rainfall data, it actually seems like the Western Cape is fighting the biology of the plant from day one.
It really is a massive environmental reality check. I mean, the report lays out the optimal growing conditions with stark clarity.
Okay, so what does the plant actually need?
So, to grow cannabis successfully outdoors, the plant requires more than 800 millimeters of annual rainfall.
It sounds like a lot.
It is. And for industrial hemp, you need over 650 millimeters. But the critical detail here, the real kicker, is the timing.
When it rains.
Yes. Both of these crops need that heavy rain specifically between October and March.
Which is their prime vegetative and flowering season.
Exactly. That's when the plant is doing all the heavy lifting.
And this is a massive problem because the Western Cape is famous for its Mediterranean climate.
Yes, which is great for wine.
Great for wine.
Yeah.
But a Mediterranean climate means wet winters and very dry summers.
Yep.
So right when the cannabis or hemp plant is like literally screaming for water between October and March, the sky is just completely dry.
Precisely. Out in the open, the natural climate is actively working against the plant's biological life cycle. I mean, the Southern Cape is really the only area in the province that is even somewhat suited to dryland hemp production.
And even there, they have issues, right?
Yeah, even there they face a rainfall shortfall, which means if you want to grow outdoors, you are entirely dependent on heavy irrigation.
You're basically manufacturing your own climate at that point.
Exactly, which immediately drives up your base costs.
And that's just for the industrial hemp or the rugged outdoor strains. If we look at the highly lucrative medicinal cannabis market, I mean, you can't just plant that in a sun-drenched field anyway.
Not if you want to sell it legally on the global market.
Right.
Medical-grade cannabis requires an environment so controlled it resembles a semiconductor factory more than a farm.
A semiconductor factory.
Literally, we're talking soilless production. You're usually utilizing a hydroponic or aeroponic medium
Okay.
with a meticulously maintained pH, usually between like 5.8 and 6.2.
That is incredibly specific.
It has to be. You need exact humidity controls to prevent micropathogens. Precise lighting schedules dictating exactly 12 hours of light for flowering.
Wow.
And on top of all that, you have to use genetically identical cloned plants to ensure absolute pharmaceutical consistency from batch to batch.
So it sounds like trying to host a winter sports competition in a desert.
That is a great way to put it.
Like you can technically do it, right?
Yeah.
But making your own snow and chilling the air is going to completely destroy your profit margins.
Yes,
So
exactly.
if the climate is fighting them this hard and the infrastructure costs are astronomical, why bother? I mean, why not just concede the raw agricultural side to regions that actually have the perfect weather?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, conceding that raw cultivation layer is kind of exactly what they are attempting to do.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The CAM plan recognizes that they cannot win a race to the bottom on sheep farming.
Because of that climate mismatch.
Right. The input costs in the Western Cape are inherently higher compared to places with naturally perfect humid climates.
Like where?
Well, locally, they are competing against regions like KwaZulu-Natal or Lesotho. And globally, against a powerhouse like Colombia, where the climate practically does the work for you.
Right. Colombia is the perfect setup.
So the conversation in this plan naturally shifts to where the Western Cape actually can make its money.
Okay.
And that requires unlocking the higher tiers of the value chain, downstream processing.
Because the economics of just selling the raw plant are looking incredibly dangerous right now, aren't they?
Oh, completely.
Because if you're an investor looking at this space, I feel like the instinct is often to just buy up cheap land and plant as much acreage as possible.
Yeah. The volume play.
Right. But the CAN plan is basically waving a massive red flag at that volume-based strategy.
Because the global prices for raw medicinal cannabis are dropping like a stone.
Wow. Dropping.
Yes. As the international industry formalizes, massive heavyweights like Thailand, Colombia, and even highly subsidized North American mega farms are just flooding the export market.
So there's too much supply.
Exactly. You simply cannot compete on volume and price if your basic input costs are inherently higher.
Right, like pumping millions of liters of irrigation water because you don't have summer rain.
Exactly. You're losing before you even start.
Okay, I understand the price collapse for medicinal cannabis. That makes sense. But what about hemp?
Ah, hemp.
Because we have been sold this idea for years, that industrial hemp is the ultimate agricultural multitasker.
The miracle crop.
Right. The miracle crop that will save the world.
Yeah.
Like, it yields high-value oil from the seeds at the top, and then industrial fiber from the stalks at the bottom. Surely that's a cash cow.
Well, what's fascinating here is how the report completely dismantles that exact myth.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Hemp has its own brutal economic physics, particularly when it comes to logistics.
Oh, so.
Hemp fiber has a very low value-to-weight ratio. It is incredibly bulky, very heavy, but relatively cheap per ton.
Oh, I see.
So the economics of aggregating that raw fiber from the field and then transporting it to a centralized processing facility, it's highly vulnerable to fuel and logistics costs.
Because you're moving so much weight.
Exactly. You can literally burn up all your potential profits just putting the hemp on a truck before it even reaches a factory door.
That completely shatters the sort of Silicon Valley pitch for hemp.
It really does.
The idea that one single crop gives you a premium fiber harvest and a premium seed harvest simultaneously.
Yeah, but looking at the biological realities outlined in the sources, it's just structurally impossible.
Wait, impossible? Why?
It is a biological trade-off. You cannot maximize both from the same field.
Okay, break that down for me.
The plant husbandry requires you to make a definitive choice early on. If your goal is premium fiber, like for textiles or construction, you have to plant the hemp seeds incredibly close together.
Okay, to crowd them.
Right. This creates a highly competitive environment for sunlight. The plants panic, and their stalks shoot straight up, tall and thin, without branching out.
Oh, because they're reaching for the light.
Exactly. And then you harvest them early, around the 90-day mark, before the fibers become too woody.
But if they don't branch out, and you harvest them early, they never get the chance to flower and produce seeds.
Exactly. You lose the seed harvest. Conversely, if you want a high yield of seeds for oil or food products, the plants need significant physical space.
They need room to grow.
Yes. They need room to branch out laterally, to flower, to mature. So you have to leave them in the ground for about 120 to 140 days.
So the spacing, the thinning, the nutrient mix, and the harvest times, they're entirely different agricultural strategies.
Entirely different.
It sounds like a Swiss Army knife where you can only ever open one tool.
That is a perfect analogy. And furthermore, hemp biomass is only about 20 to 40% fiber anyway.
Really? What's the rest?
Well, a fresh harvest holds a massive amount of water weight, which just adds to that logistical nightmare of moving it that we talked about earlier.
Wow. Okay, so if the raw farming economics are a race to the bottom, the logistics of hemp are a nightmare. And the physical climate requires massive infrastructure investment.
It's a tough sell.
It is. You'd assume the government would make it incredibly easy to get a business off the ground to compensate, right? Like, give the farmers a break on the paperwork.
You would hope so.
But looking at the legal framework breaking down in this report, it seems the opposite is true. we are entering a red tape jungle.
The legal hurdles are staggering. And what's crucial to understand here is the transversal nature of the regulations.
Transversal meaning it crosses different departments.
Exactly. Cannabis isn't as treated as a tomato or a field of wheat. Because of the varying THC levels in the plant and, you know, the heavy historical baggage of the global drug war.
Right.
The regulation doesn't just sit with the Department of Agriculture. It spans the Department of Health, the South African Police Service, and the Justice Department.
Oh, wow.
And every single one of those departments has a different mandate and a different risk appetite.
The report breaks this down into a permitted list versus a gray or constrained list.
Yes.
Under the permitted side, you can produce medical cannabis, but only if you have a license under the Medicines and Related Substances Act.
Right.
You can grow hemp for fiber and seed, provided you secure a permit under the Plant Improvement Act.
Correct.
You can sell CBD health products, but the daily dose is strictly capped under 20 milligrams.
Yeah.
And you can grow a small amount for private personal consumption, which sounds somewhat structured until you look at how those permits are actually acquired.
That's where things get messy.
There is a catch-22 with the medical licenses that is, frankly, absurd.
It really raises an important question about how governments design these rules without consulting the actual economic reality on the ground.
Yeah.
To get a license to grow medical cannabis, you are required to operate an EU GMP compliant facility.
Okay, just to ground that for a second for you listening. EU GMP, or European Union Good Manufacturing Practice.
Yeah.
It isn't just a certificate you print out and hang on the wall.
No, not at all.
We're talking pharmaceutical grade clean rooms, hermetically sealed doors, employees in hazmat-style suits, highly controlled HVAC systems that filter out microscopic particulates.
It's intense.
You essentially have to build a multi-million dollar laboratory in the middle of a farm.
Yes, and here is the actual catch-22. The regulator requires you to fully build that multi-million dollar EU GMP facility first.
Wait, first?
First. Before you get the license? There is no conditional approval.
You're joking.
Nope. You cannot get the license, show it to a bank to get a loan, and then build. You have to risk millions of rand, pour the concrete, install the HVAC systems, and build the clean rooms before you even know if the government will legally allow you to turn the lights on and plant a single seed.
That is insane. It completely locks out anyone without massive pre-existing venture capital backing.
It absolutely does.
And the regulations for hemp are just as disconnected from the agricultural reality, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because the report points out a strict 50-hectare limit for hemp permits.
Which is wild.
But we just established that hemp fiber is a low-value, high-bulk commodity. If you artificially cap a farm at 50 hectares, you completely ruin the economies of scale needed to make that crop profitable.
You do. But honestly, the most terrifying regulation has to be the 8.2% THC threshold for industrial hemp.
Okay, yeah, explain this one because it blew my mind.
It is an administrative nightmare. Globally and in South Africa, for a cannabis plant to be legally classified as industrial hemp, its THC content must remain below 0.2%.
Okay.
If it crosses that line, even by a fraction, it is legally considered a narcotic.
Right.
But THC isn't just a static ingredient. It fluctuates naturally during the plant's life cycle based on environmental stress.
Wait, so if a farmer is growing a perfectly legal field of hemp and there's an unexpected heat wave, that stress can turn them into a drug trafficker in the eyes of the law.
Biologically, yes.
That's crazy.
When a cannabis or hemp plant experiences extreme stress, like a sudden lack of water or a massive spike in temperature, it goes into survival mode.
Oh, I see.
As a defense mechanism against the UV radiation and the heat, the plant produces more resin. And that resin contains cannabinoids, including THC. So a heat wave hits the Western Cape. The plant defends itself by producing resin. The THC level spikes to, say, 0.3%.
And suddenly an entire 50-hectare crop must be legally destroyed.
Exactly. And the farmer could face criminal charges. Testing and enforcing this in real time across hundreds of farms is nearly impossible.
But the most devastating hurdle in this entire report isn't a chemical threshold or a clean room requirement.
No, it's not.
It's the socioeconomic barrier. We are talking about the legacy growers.
Yes, this is a huge issue.
The indigenous Khois and San communities and the Rastafari communities in the Western Cape, these are the people who have deep cultural traditional knowledge of this plant.
Right.
They've been cultivating local landrace strains for generations, keeping the genetic history alive while the rest of the world was trying to eradicate it.
And this is where the legal framework creates a massive injustice.
Yeah.
Because of the aggressive historical policing of cannabis, many individuals in these legacy communities have criminal records for possession or cultivation.
Right, from years ago.
Exactly. But now that the industry is formalizing, and there are billions of dollars of corporate investment on the table, those historical criminal records legally block them from participating in the newly regulated market.
It's so backwards.
The Drugs and Drug Trafficking Act and the Criminal Procedure Act effectively keep them entirely out of the legal system.
It's like arresting someone for jaywalking every day for 20 years. And then when the city finally builds a pedestrian crosswalk, telling them they aren't allowed to use it because they have a history of jaywalking.
That is a harsh but very accurate way to put it.
The very people who maintain the genetic library of this plant are disqualified by the paperwork of its legalization.
And it creates a massive, unrecognized middle ground. These legacy growers are cultivating what we call landrace species.
Landrace, what does that mean exactly?
So they are wild, resilient strains of cannabis that have naturally adapted over centuries to the specific, harsh microclimates of the Western Cape.
Oh, okay, so they're perfectly suited for the environment.
Yes. But these landraces naturally fall outside the strict 0.2% THC hemp definition. But they also aren't the pharmaceutical-grade, sterile indoor clones required by the medical market.
So they don't fit in either box.
Exactly. So the legacy growers and their unique plants are trapped in an illegal gray zone.
So, to take stock for you listening, we have harsh environmental realities requiring massive water in a dry summer, a brutal global economic price drop, a logistical nightmare for transport, and a legal system that requires you to be a multimillionaire without a criminal record just to plant a seed.
It paints a pretty bleak picture.
It really does. How on earth does the Western Cape plan to actually succeed with all this?
Well, this is where we get to the core of the document, the Adaptive Master Plan.
Okay, let's hear it.
The Western Cape Department of Agriculture designed a 9-point foundational strategy. They looked at their dry environment, they looked at the crushing global prices, and they realized their edge isn't in cheap primary farming.
So where is their edge?
Their edge is in their highly developed tertiary economy.
Here's where it gets really interesting for you. They aren't just trying to become the biggest farm.
No.
They are trying to become the Silicon Valley and the Champagne region for cannabis all at once. How are they pivoting into that tertiary space?
They are leaning heavily into their advanced research, biotech capabilities, and existing highly specialized manufacturing sectors.
Like what?
They want to integrate cannabis and hemp into unexpected high-value end uses. For instance, the Western Cape has a booming, world-class marine manufacturing and boat-building industry.
Which is definitely not the first thing you think of when you hear the word cannabis.
Not at all. But the plan actively explores linking hemp fiber standards directly to boat-building regulations.
How does that work?
They are researching how to replace traditional fiberglass with woven hemp fibers set in advanced epoxy matrices.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This creates marine composites that are not only lighter, but significantly reduce the carbon footprint of the vessel while maintaining high tensile strength.
That's brilliant. By integrating hemp into an existing high-tech export industry like boat building, they bypass the cheap textile market entirely.
Completely bypass it. And they're also looking at the construction sector, pushing to integrate hempcrete into the national building regulations as a premier sustainable insulation and structural material.
And they are also utilizing the plant to solve existing agricultural problems, right? I saw the section on phytoremediation.
Yes, phytoremediation is a fascinating application. Hemp is an incredibly aggressive bioaccumulator.
Meaning it soaks things up.
Exactly. It absorbs whatever's in the soil. So the plan assesses using hemp as a rotation crop, not necessarily to harvest for fiber, but to actually pull heavy metals and chemical toxins out of depleted commercial farmland.
That is so smart.
It acts as an environmental sponge, rehabilitating the soil for future food crops while generating carbon credits at the same time.
But what about those legacy growers, the ones trapped in the gray zone with their historical criminal records and their wild landrace strains? How does the whole Champagne region analogy fit into saving them?
This is arguably the most innovative policy concept in the entire CAN plan. The Western Cape wants to establish geographic indicators, like a trademark or a collective mark, to legitimize and protect unique Western Cape legacy strains and traditional knowledge.
So just like sparkling wine can only legally be called champagne if it comes from the Champagne region of France and follows their specific heritage rules.
Precisely. They want to do exactly that for local landrace cannabis.
That is so cool.
By creating a geographic indicator for, say, a specific Swartberg or Transkei strain, they turn a local climatic quirk and a historical tradition into a premium, globally recognized brand.
Right. So you aren't just buying generic medical THC.
No, you are buying a heritage product.
Yeah.
And if you combine that with a push for cannatourism linking cannabis agritourism with the Western Cape's already world-class wine routes.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Right. You create a totally different value proposition that specifically empowers the legacy growers. It gives them a premium market that the sterile indoor corporate facilities literally cannot replicate.
And the genius of this 9-point plan is that it is explicitly described as adaptive.
Yes. Adaptive is the key word.
Because they know the national laws are currently a contradictory mess. They know that things like the private use bill or the scheduling of CBD will eventually loosen up as the global consensus changes.
Exactly. They aren't waiting for the laws to be perfect.
Right.
They are setting up the foundational initiatives right now. Education and training programs, establishing industry problem-solving forums, mapping the value chains, and providing extension services to help mainstream those legacy producers.
So this master plan is essentially designed to sit there like a coiled spring.
Yes, exactly.
It is positioned to trigger new phases of investment the exact moment the national regulatory environment changes. When the legal gates finally open, the Western Cape won't be scrambling to catch up. They will already be running.
That's the entire strategy right there.
So what does this all mean for you, navigating this space? We started with the harsh reality that the Western Cape's Mediterranean climate lacks the summer rain needed to cheaply grow these crops.
Yep.
We shattered the myth of the miracle crop, seeing how the brutal logistics of hemp fiber and the crashing global prices of medicinal cannabis make traditional volume-based farming a total losing game.
A race to the bottom.
We hacked through a red tape jungle where a biological response to a heat wave can turn a farmer into a trafficker and where the true pioneers of the plant are locked out by their path.
It's a lot to navigate.
It is. And finally, we arrived at a masterclass in adaptation. A tech and heritage-driven plan that leverages marine boat building, phytoremediation, and premium geographic indicators to find a really sharp competitive edge.
It is a blueprint for how a region can pivot from a natural disadvantage into a highly specialized, defensible market position.
And whether you are analyzing agricultural economics or looking for investment vectors in the biotech space or just fascinated by how global policies shift, this CAN plan shows us exactly how governments attempt to herd a wild, stigmatized plant into a structured, profitable, and equitable modern industry.
It really does. And if I can leave you with a final thought from the report to linger on, please do.
We talked about the push to protect those local landrace cannabis strains through geographic indicators.
Yeah, the champagne of cannabis.
Yeah. These are wild, highly resilient plants that have spent centuries adapting to the harsh, dry conditions of the Cape. But the global corporate industry is rushing in the exact opposite direction.
How so?
Billions of dollars are being poured into genetically identical, sterile indoor clones, optimized purely for pharmaceutical consistency and maximum yield in a perfect artificial environment.
Like the semiconductor factory we talked about.
Exactly. And this raises an important question. As the money flows towards standardized factory floor perfection, what happens to the wild, rugged genetics of those traditional landraces?
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought about that.
Because if a new disease or a sudden climate shift wipes out those identical indoor clones, we will desperately need the genetic resilience of the wild plants.
To save the crop.
Right. In our rush to perfect the plant for the pharmaceutical market, are we accidentally engineering its history and its survival toolkit completely out of existence? Which brings us right back to where we started. We are trying to force nature into that predictable glass-roofed factory. But as the Western Cape is learning, sometimes the greatest value and the key to long-term survival is actually found in the wild things that refuse to be easily categorized. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.